Good morning.
What a large number of people.
First of all, thank you very much for inviting me here. And as Jeff pointed out, we had the pleasure of working together a few years ago around enabling information sharing and ICT strategy. So first thing, be nice to people, because you never know where they're going to pop up in your lives. The second thing is that data is the thing at the moment. Thank you. So, as Jeff pointed out, my current title is Chief Data Scientist for the New South Wales Data Analytics Centre. You might have seen little brackets interim in there, interim/acting/, let's work it out at some point in the future. The Data Analytics Centre was established back in August. Minister Dominello announced it with some fanfare, which was great, and the whole intention was to do something which is more significant in terms of the problems we're looking to address. The challenges we're looking at are what's called wicked problems. So they're complex, they're subtle, and ultimately they have people's behaviour at the heart of them. And different agencies are doing things with data. Certainly linking data sets together is something that Justice and Fair Trading and Health have been doing for a very long time. And it all really starts with finding the data, linking it together, and then identifying things in the data that you really didn't expect. And that work is going on in many different parts of the world. But the Data Analytics Centre is really trying to do something a little higher in terms of the scale of the ambition of the challenges we're looking to address. And so the reason I have interim acting, maybe let's think about it, Chief Data Scientist is my title, is that I was busily doing something completely different. I was working in financial markets after 5 years at CSIRO and looking at some really amazing people doing some really amazing science. And it became increasingly clear that everything, once you capture something from the physical world into the virtual world, once you digitize it, everything starts to look like a really interesting data challenge. And that's true whether or not you're talking about ecosystems or businesses or financial markets or farming or factories or hospitals. Once you virtualize the physical world, once you capture the physical world in data, you can do some pretty amazing things. Link, model, analyze, optimize. So what I'm trying to bring to the Data Analytics Center is that concept that everything can be digitized. There's a representation of everything in the physical world, everything in the systems and networks and processes and environments we operate in, which can be brought into the digital world. And then we can start to bring that same data science capability to bear to try and tackle some of these wicked challenges. So, in summary of the presentation, if you'd rather just switch off and have a nice little nap, the summary of the presentation is it's complex. We should not avoid the complexity, we should embrace the complexity. That everything can be brought into the digital world in some way, shape or form. And then the power really comes from connecting it together. And the reason I did that last minute change to my presentation just now is I thought, you know what, I think you guys will get it. And maybe you'd appreciate a couple more really exciting slides, because no one ever has enough slides in their presentation. So that's what I'm going to talk about. So if you want to switch off, now's the time. I'll wake you back up at the end. But otherwise, stay tuned. And we're going to do a little, first of all, a few macro points, a few trends, a few things which seem relevant, some things which you'll wonder how they're possibly relevant, and hopefully bring it back together at the end. Then I'm going to talk about some of the projects we're doing at the Data Analytics Centre, which is really, of course, why I'm here. So, let's start. My first point is that we live in a really complex world. It's really, really complex. This is a photo from Brisbane from last October. There were some really big storms that came along in the Brisbane area. And I just love this photograph, because what it shows is that in each one of these offices, there's either a meeting going on or there's someone sitting at the desk working away, and they're trying to really simplify the world around them. They're trying to cut out detail, they're trying to cut out complexity. They are keeping it simple. There's another S on the end there. I'll leave that one for you to decide because it's being recorded. They're keeping it simple. And we do that because we, as people, make decisions with simplified boundaries. It's hard for us to cope with complexity. If you remember the first time we ever walked into a US fast food store and saw a world of options in front of you and thought, I'll just take a cheeseburger, thanks. We're really bad at making decisions, as people, with complexity. So we simplify. and then we plan and we rationalise and we linearise and we say this is how, this is our, what our projections are, this is where we're going, this is our business model, this is da, 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 da. We do it, we all do it, and we're taught from a very young age to do it because we don't handle complexity well. But every one of those offices is connected to every other office, either physically in the same building, electrically, through water, through sewerage, through power lines, they're connected. Every one of those buildings is connected to every other building. They're in a city. They're connected by roads and telecoms and sewerage and lighting and da-da-da. And of course, there's a much, much, much bigger ecosystem also in operation, the environment. If you ignore the environment, then you really have simplified quite a lot. And normally we just take it for granted. But on days like this, it's pretty hard not to take into consideration weather. And weather has a really, really big impact on everything we do. We are so affected by the weather. It rained, yesterday was Monday, I believe. It rained. So it means that no one's taking the trains, everyone's driving into work, and everyone's driving cautiously, car parks are full. The biggest predictor of whether or not car parks will be full is if it rains. The biggest predictor of delays on roads is if it rains. We as people ignore the weather, we ignore our environment because it's complex, but the practical situation is it's a short-term driver, it's also a significant long-term driver. There's the gentleman who won New South Wales Scientist of the Year, Mark Westerby, talked about his predictions for what the world would look like 100 years from now. And he predicted that the climate in Australia will have changed, increased in temperature by between 5 and 7 degrees Celsius. And that doesn't sound like a lot. But one of the interesting consequences of that is that where things grow is very much determined by which climactic zone they're in. So the practical situation is that Sydney's temperature doesn't just increase by 5 to 7 degrees. Big deal. 20 to 25 doesn't sound like much. 30 to 35 doesn't sound like much. 40 to 45 doesn't sound like much. But the climate bands actually migrate south. So the climate of Cairns goes to Townsville, Townsville goes to Gold Coast, Gold Coast goes to Coffs Harbour, Coffs Harbour goes to Sydney, Sydney goes to Melbourne. Only winner there is Melbourne. But it also means the things that can grow in those zones change. The ability of the eucalypt, the gum tree, to stand long-term temperature variations is actually very, very small. It's only a couple of degrees, 2 or 3 degrees, which means that where you see today eucalypts growing, you won't see if the climate, if the temperature increases by 5 to 7 degrees. They just can't grow. So in fact, all the vegetation bands also start to propagate south. So you see a very, very different environment, not just increased temperature. So the point of that fairly long diversion is that the world we live in is subtle and complex. The problems we care about are subtle and complex. And typically the problems we care about as government are the ones that have human behaviour at the heart of them. So everything we really are interested in and looking to bring to bear with this data analytics ultimately has behaviour at the heart of it. And of course, we humans really continue to behave in exactly the same way. The hardest thing to do is change behaviour. This is not Parramatta Road. This is a highway in Silicon Valley. Every morning we get up, we go to work. Every morning take the kids to school. The drivers of peak hour, literally, are absolutely clearly known and understood. And it's extraordinarily difficult to change our behaviour. So every person in every one of those cars will have a cell phone, will have radio, will have access to a variety of communications, entertainment, comfort capabilities. And they will sit in their car for an hour and a half, 2 hours, each day, each way. Now there's a frightening exercise you can do. Just imagine you travel to work, just say it's an hour each day each way, 5 days a week, one direction in, one direction out, count up the number of hours you spend commuting, work in how many weeks come to work, calculate the total number of hours, then work out how many hours of leave you get each year. And don't forget, you only get leave for the 9 to 5, you don't get leave for the stuff after that, because you're supposed to be on leave, you're not supposed to be working. And you'll see pretty quickly, I see a few faces, a few horrid looks on the people's faces, they just worked through the maths and realised you spend more time commuting each year than you spend on vacation. And yet, we are now more connected than we've ever been. We're in a more sophisticated, flexible working environment than we've ever been before. And yet this happens every single day on every major road of every major city. Behaviour is a really difficult thing to change. We go to work, roughly speaking, the same time. Kids go to school, roughly speaking, the same time. People expect you to be in the office, roughly speaking, the same time. And so this happens ever around the world. And, remarkably, people don't take public transport. There's a slide I'll get to in a moment, but one of the problems we're looking at is behaviour of passengers and the choices they make about do I or do I not take public transport. And the answer is most people don't. So, changing behaviour is the single hardest thing to do, because ultimately it means changing people's minds, changing people's value systems, changing people's beliefs. Now the other main point is that the easy stuff has been done. Anybody recognise this? This was my lunch yesterday. It's an orange with mould on it. And of course from that we got penicillin. And this bit luckily isn't being recorded by the podcast. But penicillin, developed and industrialised in the 20th century, had an incredible impact on the welfare and well-being of soldiers who've been injured in battle. People, once upon a time you get a wound and then you die of blood poisoning, septicemia. Penicillin dramatically changed the survival rates for people at the front line. But then of course they realise it has other impacts. It can cure social ills. It can address entertainment or lifestyle based challenges. And this is a real ad from Second World War where it says, penicillin cures social challenges. Didn't get reported to put on the podcast. But of course it was developed using wet chemistry, good old fashioned research in a wet chemical lab. And the industrialisation process was a very difficult activity and it required really significant scaling up of that very precise, very careful wet chemistry. And the scaling up was really part of the challenge for the Second World War. If we were going to do it now, we'd do it in a completely different way. We would say we want a molecule that has these electrical characteristics, these chemical characteristics, this shape. It should be this long, and it should be kind of like this, and then we go hunting for it in the data space. We can quite literally design chemicals and molecules using data and analytical techniques. Not sure if any of you have ever tried it, but there's an application you can download and offer free compute cycles for your home computer called Foldit. And they're looking for molecules for a variety of different purposes, and some of them relate to malaria, some that relate to just the design of new drugs. And you can run this sort of stuff on your laptop at home where it will try all combinations of different chemicals or chemical bonds, and you can help design one of these things strictly in data. Once it's designed, it then needs to be created in the physical world. But right up until that point, everything about it is data-driven, not driven by wet chemistry. So some of the new designer drugs we're looking at are really purely in the world of data until ultimately they're manifested. And the manifestation process is almost as simple as 3D printing, almost as simple. And then of course there's us. So we are unique, we are special, we are separate from the animal kingdom, we are a unique species on top of the ladder. And yet, I put my DNA material into some sort of processing environment, and the exact code which represents me, my 6 billion nucleotides, can actually be mapped into a 4-letter code. The very first time it was done was back in the 70s, and it was really quite a shock to people that we could be mapped to a 4-letter code. The thing that makes us unique, an individual, me separate from Jeff, Jeff separate from someone else, gets mapped into a 4-letter code. Now that's not to say that you could reproduce myself or Jeff from that 4-letter code, but everything about us which is unique, all of our hidden programming, can now be mapped to a 4-letter code. And that was a bit of a revelation point. But of course it was difficult. So in the 70s, again, wet chemistry, a really long process. The first full genome mapping cost billions, depending on exactly how you measure it, billions of dollars, and took a very, very long time. Now, you can do it in minutes. I had the great pleasure of going to Silicon Valley last year and seeing a friend who's got his latest startup running, where he's quite literally mapping genetic material on a chip. So Some of you may have heard of this thing called graphene. Graphene's a single layer of carbon molecules. It's literally two-dimensional. It's the first ever two-dimensional structure created. It's one atom thick, so let's call it two-dimensional among strings. And what effectively this thing does is reverse the 3D printing. So you put in genetic material on the chip, takes a slice, you have one code, another slice, another code, another slice, another code. And it does that, roughly speaking, 6 billion times, and you've got your material. Now, that maps to produce a very large file. It's 250 gigabytes of data, which means that four of us would fit very comfortably on this laptop hard drive. So you and three friends can live comfortably, or all of your unique description can live comfortably on a laptop, and you can carry it around and show it to your friends. And it can be done in minutes. So my friend hasn't yet revealed the price, but they're already talking about $1,000 genome sequencing, and this will almost certainly be sub-$1,000. But you can do it in minutes, and you can do it for a very small amount of money. So essentially anyone could do it. So we, and the uniqueness of us, can be that to data. That has some interesting implications. When you start thinking about designer drugs and designer molecules and understanding the genome sequences for an individual, we're not yet at the point of being able to design molecules for individuals, because that's still very expensive. What we can do is look across the range of different drug treatments and think about which ones are most effective for this particular set of genome sequences. So a lot of the DNA that we have is not really understood what it's for, but there are some active binding points where you could identify which drugs work more effectively for people with particular genome sequences. So, interesting. And that, by the way, that little figure on the right is the cost per genome sequence. And you'll see that there's also Moore's Law. Everyone's heard about Moore's Law on the number of transistors on a chip. It doubles every 18 months or so. Moore's Law has been pretty effective at predicting really powerful and amazing increases in compute. And then, of course, the cost of sequencing was following that pretty nicely. And then it's suddenly a major breakthrough in how it was done, and a very, very different cost profile for genome sequencing and also the time associated with it. So something to think about. If you're stuck for a present, if you're married, think, you know, maybe we'll do genome sequencing for Christmas or a special birthday, and then buy a bigger laptop and a bigger hard drive. Put the whole family on it. And then you can send the hard drive off for a holiday. Much, much cheaper. All right. Something else which is really interesting is the increase in digital products. And we live in a services economy. The statistics are that more than around about 80% of our whole GDP is services based. And a really big part of that is digital services. So if you do online banking or if you buy insurance online, that's a digital service. But more and more, we're actually also talking about digital products. And one of the really interesting things, of course, about a digital service, as opposed to someone cutting your hair, but if you're buying insurance online, not only do you use that service, and not only would you treat that service the same way as if someone sold you insurance with a piece of paper, but your interaction with that online service itself creates data. The ease of use, how readily you went from browsing to purchasing, your translation rate, your experience in that browsing session, all of that is captured as data. And of course, now we're starting to talk about the fact that we're creating digital products. So not only can you use digital products in the equivalent to their non-digital equivalent products, by that I mean the real world, so not only can you use digital products in the same way as you would a non-digital product, the interaction with that digital product can also be captured, and that can be used to more carefully, more accurately, and more effectively target that digital product. So this is another great photo. I just love this one. So floating around in the International Space Station, the astronaut up there forgot to take a widget. In this case, it was a spanner. The guys on the ground design the spanner, design one specifically for their need, send it up with the file, 3D print out on the space station. Wow. Once upon a time, everything you could possibly imagine you need to put on the spacecraft, you send it up, use it or don't use it. It costs time, it costs payload, it costs fuel. Now if you forget to take something, just print it out once you get up there. And again, so that's now sent as a digital product, which then gets recreated in the physical world from that digital product, from that file. But also all the interactions with that digital product itself can be captured to help make it more specific, more interactive, more effective, better targeted. But I think that's pretty cool. At the moment, we print with plastics, and some of you may have 3D printers at home, but we're already, the CSIRO folks have been printing titanium for some time. Last Melbourne Cup, they printed titanium horseshoes for the horses, which were specifically matched to the needs of the horse itself. They've been printing titanium hips for quite some time, scan the joint, print a titanium hip, put it in place so it's exactly matched to the needs of the patient. There have been efforts to print with organic molecules, so creating 3D printed food. And in fact, anything you've ever seen on Star Trek or Star Wars is currently undergoing the investigation through 3D printing. The Captain Kirk comes in, presses the button, gets his Jean-Luc Picard gets his Earl Grey tea and his bacon tomato sandwich in outer space. All of those things are being examined in terms of being able to 3D print. So you send the file, you send the request, print in some material, manifests back in the physical world. Another trend I wanted to talk about is, so hopefully by now you're starting to believe the point that anything in the physical world can be mapped to the digital world, and that mapping isn't necessarily one way. You can potentially map it back the other way. Imagine 3D printing someone's genome. But the power really starts to come when you connect data sets together, and that's what gets really, really interesting. And the Internet of Things is a really powerful idea at the moment, and it's been manifested in a number of different forms. But the basic principle is that you could put an inexpensive sensor on anything, literally anything. You can then capture data from that sensor and bring it back together, link it, which is the first step in doing analytics, but linking it together. And then you've got a powerful, rich set of data sets you can start to do some really powerful investigation on. And some of the ideas have been really quite humorous. For example, smart fridge, smart toaster, smart fridge and toaster talk to each other. And those ideas have been around for quite some time. But they don't deliver a lot of value. However, once you start to add intelligence to that sensor, or once you make those sensors far, far, far more ubiquitous, then your ability to sample the physical world starts to become much richer. This is a lovely little example of a fridge which was implicated in a spamming activity, loosely titled A New Front on the Cold War. A fridge was implicated in sending 750,000 spam emails, which is not exactly what you buy the fridge for, but of course anything which has got intelligence and connectivity can be hacked. But the interesting thing, of course, is that it becomes a node in a much, much bigger network. In Barcelona, the folks at Cisco connected up as much of the city as they possibly could, including these garbage cans. And the garbage cans were saying, I'm full, I'm not full, empty me, don't bother emptying me. And they connected parking meters, they connected fire hydrants, they connected a whole lot of different devices together and claimed some pretty phenomenal benefits from the ability to connect everything together. $58 million in annual savings, $50 million annual increase in revenues from smart parking, 47,000 new jobs. So let's call this the Internet of Things, the Internet of Trashy Things in this case. And of course, if you really start to take this to the extreme, you can connect anything. You can generate data from anything. So this is not a doctored photo, this is a real photo. The folks at CSIRO in Tasmania were looking at the peril of bees. So you may have heard that all around the world there's been a declining population of bees. So a study was done jointly between Australia and South America looking at what bees do, where they go, and what's happening to them. And in this case, they quite literally stuck a chip on the back of a bee. So that bee can fly around very comfortably with that little RFID on its back, and it becomes part of the Internet of Things. The bee is addressable, it has an IP address. You gather data from the bee, where it's going, where it's flying, where it rests, which flowers it goes to, and it becomes, quite literally, part of the Internet of Things. In this case, we said it's the Internet of Little Things. It's also the Internet of Furry Things. Of course, if you can do it on bees, you can do it on bats. Another CSIRO example. In this case, they sensorized up some bats. They put a tracker on the back of it and made them part of the Internet, in this case, of flying things. But in this case, they were looking at bat movement and, in particular, the spread of diseases. Bats are a major vector of disease, in particular between species, and it's because where they sit in our ancestral tree, they are right at a point where viruses can move from a species like a horse, or from a bat to a horse to us. It actually moves through the bat as the carrier of disease. And so in this case, the good folks at CSIRO were looking at where the bats were going, and they particularly wanted to know when they inverted in the evening. The feces would fall onto the animal below, that would then carry the disease from the bat to the horse, then to the human being. But of course, these bats are all IP addressable, and you can quite literally log into them, do a software update, find out where they're going, exactly the same as you could a router, the same as you could for a small computer or for a fridge. No bat has yet been implicated in email spamming, but it's possible. The point is that you can get data from anywhere. You can connect data, and once you start to move data around, really powerful things start to happen. Now this is another interesting point about that nexus also with what's happening with international trade, in this case cross-jurisdictional trade, driven by digital services and in fact also digital products. So a gentleman called Farr some time ago spent time looking at where all the economic activity happens in the world, taking 700 hotspots, and then identifying what the geographic mean of that is over time. Not at all surprising, mid-80s, there was a lot of activity between North America and Europe, and the centre of the economic world is somewhere between the two, somewhere over the Atlantic. Over time, that starts to move towards Asia, which is great, because that's where we are. And the prediction is that by 2030, depending exactly how India and China are going, it'll wind up somewhere in the subcontinent area. A related point, though, is, of course, that the sorts of things that are being traded, the sorts of economic activity is changing. Most developed countries are moving towards being services-oriented. Most developed companies are moving to be digital services, digital economy, and there's a greater increase in the number of digital products which are being exchanged. And as a consequence of that, as this moves across towards inexorably towards New South Wales, which is lucky, the nature of what's being traded and the direction of what's being traded is actually starting to change. So back over here, it was first world countries trading with each other. As time progressed, more and more digital products, more and more digital services, more and more developing economies starting to engage with first world countries. So quite a lot is happening as those dots have been moving along, and it's all underpinned by exchange of data. There was an estimate in that previous slide, some numbers on that point. It was estimated that in 2008 the world exchanged approximately 8 petabytes of data per month. 4 years later, which is the last numbers that have been reliably published, it was closer to 40,000 petabytes of data per month being exchanged around the planet. So there's another major component. Everything can be digitised, power comes when you connect it, and things start to happen on a global scale when these connections happen. But it also starts to change the way we behave as individuals. We start to expect the world to look very, very different. And this is, again, where it starts to become really relevant for government. So this is a map of LinkedIn connections. So a few years ago, LinkedIn allowed you to look at your networks and see who you're connected to. And they stopped doing that because it was revealing a lot of information about individuals. But there are a couple of things about that which really speak to the modern context that we find ourselves in. So we as consumers, we as citizens, are increasingly more demanding, less loyal, more likely to take advice from peers, more willing to adopt new technology, and we operate in a world of reduced information asymmetry. Could you imagine buying something now, a major purchase, without doing a price comparison, using some sort of search tool or some sort of recommender system? Could you imagine buying anything from a picture you saw in a paper catalogue with a two-word or a one-sentence description that you would write a check out for, post off, and then get a physical product back? The interaction of the physical world and the virtual world has become something that we completely take for granted. But our children, and in fact even those of you who are old enough to have the next generation of children coming along, are far more likely to take advice from either their peers in their social networks, or in fact from complete strangers they've never met before, rather than walk into a bank and ask for financial planning advice, or walk into an accountant and ask for financial advice, far more likely to just ask people in their broader social network. And what it means, though, of course, is that we expect to be far better informed. We don't like the information asymmetry which historically has existed between network-centric things like hospitals or agencies or government, where just by the nature of dealing with that mass of transactions, they know more about the system than we do. They know more about us in some cases than we have access to data, simply because it's a net. The old world, the physical world, historical corporate model relies on information asymmetry, and it was just more efficient to do things that way. Now we actually expect much greater levels of information, and in particular information about us, or which is relevant to us. So we're changing, and companies are responding to that, and government needs to respond to that, because the expectation certainly is there. Well, so that was my rapid tour, and that's the thinking behind what we're trying to do at the Data Analytics Centre. We accept the fact the world is complex. We accept the fact that the problems we're looking at are subtle and constrained. And we're trying to do some really powerful things with all of those rich data sets that we know are available. So the so what of all of this is that if we can go from the data, if we can cast a really, really wide net, more than just what a single agency sees, more than what is available just through open source, but if we cast a really, really wide net, then we can bring the data, we can link it, we can take it back to what we call the information layer, which is where people make decisions, and then we can start to address some of those really difficult challenges, which go beyond the simple use cases of show me this, or benchmark me for that, or do complex event detection. We really start to get into that powerful space called machine learning, where we develop analytical models. We use those models to start heading machines off in certain directions to start finding patterns and complex events, but also allow us to do predictors, classifiers, and what-if scenario planning. But the power of this really is this casting a really, really wide net, being really ambitious in terms of where we think we can get data from. And when we're doing the design activities associated with these challenges, whether it's out-of-home care, or whether it's transport, or whether it's social housing, we ask people to ask a really ambitious question, and a question which is of the nature of, if we knew the answer to this question in real time, what would make the biggest difference to our business? And we say, be really ambitious about the data sets you want to use. Just assume they exist. And if you've got the question, if you've got the data sets, the bit in the middle is just the data science. And that's what we try and then do at the Data Analytics Center. So we really, really push for ambitious questions, because it's quite possible that with the data that we've got access to, we can ask questions that we've never been able to ask before, and we can know things that we've never been able to know before, because we cast that really wide net. So some of the projects we're looking at the moment, and I won't go into a great deal of detail, because I think the Minister would like to announce a few things about this. One of the ones we've had really great success with is automatic fire alarms. Automatic fire alarm goes off. Anybody who lives in a commercial building or in an apartment block will know the joy of the alarm going off at 3 in the morning or at 11 o'clock at night, trudging out in your pyjamas, standing in the street while it's raining, and meeting your neighbours for the first time. 48,000 automatic fire alarms went off in New South Wales last year. 97% of those were false alarms. And by law, the fire and rescue respond with 2 fire trucks. And as a consequence, 90,000 truck rolls happened last year. 97% of those alarms were false alarms, which means approximately 96,000 truck rolls were completely pointless. And not only is there a cost associated with that, there's an impact on the community of responding with lights and sirens, but there's also the crew turn up, if they don't smell smoke, they don't see flames, they think it's a false alarm, especially if there's been a repeat activity of that building. And they potentially can put themselves really in harm's way if they don't follow full safety protocol, because they know it's a false alarm. And there are real anecdotal stories of that happening. So there's a safety incident. There's also a cost and an impact on society component to this. So social outcomes as well as economic outcomes. But the interesting thing is that if we can predict it's a false alarm, we can also pretty well understand how significant it is if it's not a false alarm. And so what ultimately we're trying to answer the question of is, how do we tell the crew before they arrive the scale of a developing incident, from the point where we know it's a false alarm with very high certainty to we actually strongly believe this is a real event and it's developing rapidly and your escalation plans need to be in place as quickly as possible, which helps the crew then prioritise, or the dispatch office prioritise, based on a multi-event day. On days of strong storms and strong winds, or in fact if there's a terrorist event, or a large number of different sorts of activities taking place, the ability to prioritise based on impact and likelihood is a tool ultimately we're looking to give fire and rescue. And it's looking very, very promising. And we've drawn on a really wide range of data sets. The alarm data is very thin. We've looked at social media, we've looked at weather, we've looked at building type, hour of day, time of day, week of year, month of year, season. We've looked at some of the main drivers of false alarms, believe it or not, cooking, insects, air quality, dust. And we're getting really close to being able to predict very accurately which ones are at least false alarms and which ones we're certain are actual events. Another one we're looking at is out-of-home care. And in this case, there are so many touch points that a family or a child has with New South Wales government, but the lens that every single agency sees that child through tends to be limited by your engagement with the family or the child. So Family and Community Services has a different perspective to justice, has a different perspective to health, has a different perspective to police. And if we can join those up, then we can identify a journey that a child goes on or a journey that a family goes on. And in this case, what we're looking at is trying to understand not only through the lens of all the different government agency data sets, but every other data set we can get access to, social media data, publicly available data, anything we can get to try and understand that journey and look to predict the likelihood of a child going into out-of-home care or, in fact, successfully returning from an out-of-home care project through one of the successful return mechanisms. And the ability to link all those data sets together, understand the context of the child in context to the family in context to the network that it sits in, we strongly believe we can build a predictor which will give us, with high likelihood, the ability to predict in 1 year, 2 years, or 3 years, the likelihood of a child going into out-of-home care. Conversely, the likelihood of success, of a successful return for a child back to a family, or through some other exit mechanism. We're also looking at a major urban renewal activity, so South Sydney, Botany and Randwick, looking at developing a population model. And in this case, very often population models are taken from census, you have a few years of accumulated assumptions, and then demographers project out and say, in 5 years this is how many people will be there, in 10 years this is how many people will be there. And inward migration, outward migration, births and deaths are the main drivers. Pretty reasonable stuff. Census is a nice slice in time, but the 5 years between census means that you've got an accumulated set of assumptions as time progresses. So what we're looking to do is take two approaches here and identify who lives where with whom. We don't want to know individuals, but we do want to know the mix of families, and use what we call machine learning to project forward 5 years and then 10 years. And there we're looking at a variety of indicators of activity of people moving into neighbourhoods and moving out of the neighbourhoods, so water connections, electricity connections, but a whole lot of other things as well, school enrolments, car registrations, a whole lot of other indicators, and we throw everything at the machine and we say to the machine, you tell us what's relevant, you project what the 2011 census would be, you then project what the next one will be, and then we'll go from that point forward. And that gives us a static model, that tells us who lives there. And the objective of this project is to understand the need for transport, for education, schools, for hospital infrastructure, health infrastructure, for water and electricity. Now the interesting thing, of course, is that if you add transport to that, it changes the population. If you build a school and the school's good, it changes the population, changes demand for housing. Similarly, if you build a hospital, it changes demand for housing. So this isn't actually a static process. This is actually a dynamic process. So we're also looking at building a dynamic population model. We want to know who lives there with whom. Again, we don't want to know individuals, we just want to know the mix. We want to know who travels out of that region each day, who travels into that region each day, who travels around that region each day, who stays put. And staying put means people staying at home, there's a hospital, there's also hotels, and of course there's also a jail there, so there's another reason for people to stay put. So we're looking at dynamic population model, where ideally we want to know day by day, week by week, month by month, who's there, what the peak demand is for infrastructure, for transport, for health, for education, for water and electricity. And the time frames are different for these different infrastructure types. So for public transport, we might actually want to know minute by minute what the population is. But for water connections, we'd be comfortable to know what the daily peak demand is. And for that, we're looking at a variety of other data sets. So mobile phone data, mobile data, car park data, you name it. We're really casting a very, very wide net. Litter count, crime rates, graffiti count. So we're looking at a whole lot of indicators of dynamic population. And the last one I'm going to talk about very, very quickly is transport. So this is one of the first projects we started on, was to try and understand the drivers of off-peak behaviour. Remember that photo, everyone stuck in their cars travelling to work? The whole system of transport is designed around peak hour. So between 6 and 9:30 a.m., where the peak of the peak is approximately 8 till 9. And there is billions of dollars worth of rolling stock in Sydney Metro, but it's exactly the same situation in every major city around the world. That the whole system then gets designed around that peak of the peak. But that really represents half of the total passenger journeys for the entire day. What's really, really poorly understood is what are the drivers for the off-peak for the rest of the day and also for weekends. So we spent time looking at the Sydney Rail network, 305 stations, and then of course had to factor in the bus network, because of course buses are the thing that lead to surge capacity when there's surge demand, and it's the most flexible rerouting thing you can do inside the entire network. And so we developed 305 models, inbound and outbound for each train station, hour by hour, day by day, week by week, month by month, and tried to understand what truly drives passenger behaviour. And not surprisingly, the first is weather. So when it's a rainy day, people just don't take public transport. But interestingly, on Monday morning in Parramatta, if the temperature goes up by 1 degree, 140 people fewer take the train out of Parramatta. Unless Vivid is on, in which case more than 300 people for every degree increase will take the train to an event. They decide possibly not to go to work. They instead go to go and see some amazing event. But by understanding, but in this case, we threw everything we could at it. So we had Opal data, we had journey to work data, we had where children go to school data, we had bike rack data, we had locker capacity data, we had car park capacity data, you name it, anything, weather, you name it, whatever we could get our hands on, and we looked at everything and found some really, really interesting insights. Again, I think the Minister wants to make some announcements about this later, so I won't say too much. But it was really surprising. We had some of those oh my goodness moments with transport, saying they really didn't know that was the case. And this is the problem we're trying to solve. This is really coming back to the last bit, human behaviour. So this is a map of who takes what mode of transport to work over the last 10 years. And 75% either drive or are passengers. And the big blue one there is single occupancy vehicles. A very small percentage take public transport. Now I'm trying to remember, 23% take public transport, and then 8% drive or walk or possibly take a horse to work. And that's been stable, plus or minus 1% for the last 10 years, despite all the investments in infrastructure, despite all the investments in public transport, despite introductions of everything. If you tried to build a system that stable, if you tried to engineer a solution that stable, you would have no chance of doing it. But you rely on human behaviour and trying to nudge people's behaviour, bingo, really stable systems. We are hard to change. People are hard to change. People's opinions are hard to change. Behaviour is hard to change. And the very last point I'm going to leave you with is the data. And there are three reasons why people don't share data. Unwilling, unable, not allowed. Not allowed stuff speaks to legislation. And one of the really unique thing about the Data Analytics Centre is that there's a piece of legislation which says that agencies can share data, in fact, are required to share data for a project which is endorsed by Cabinet, which is addressing one of these large challenges. And the mere fact that that legislation exists means that the unwilling starts to dissolve. So people's individual concerns about whether it's okay to share, if you point to the legislation, even without needing to enact it, even without needing to enforce it, it starts to make the whole sharing part a whole lot easier. We still operate within New South Wales and federal privacy limits, and we still operate within, ultimately, the risk appetite of government. But between what's clearly okay and what's clearly not okay, we're looking to demonstrate how we can add extra value if we push that risk appetite a little. And in some cases, like transport, we've been able to push it. In some other areas which are more conservative and much, much more sensitive, like out-of-home care, we're doing things in a much more controlled fashion. But we're, in all cases, trying to push towards the limit of what's okay and demonstrate value along the way by adding more data sets. With that, I'm going to leave you. So my key points really is that, actually it's this, everything should be made as simple as possible, but no simpler. Looking at the world through the lens of data, if you are really ambitious about the question you ask, if you're really ambitious about the data sets you want to use, and you can bring some good data science to bear, you can do some pretty amazing stuff. Thank you very much.